All right, we're going on the record. Welcome to the creditors meeting in ATP Oil and Gas Corporation, case number 12-36187H111. H1 stands for Houston, Judge Marvin Isker. It is now 7 minutes after 10, and we're going to get started. My name is Nancy Holly. I'm with the Department of Justice. I represent the United States Trustee. And I'll be the presiding officer here today and at any continued creditors meetings that we have. The purpose of this meeting is for representatives of the debtor to answer questions of their creditors and of the U.S. trustee about why this case was filed and where it's headed. And so you're welcome to ask questions when I open it to questions. You can see that we have a few limitations in this room. We have a lot of people. And I need to make a good record because we're electronically digitally recording this 341 meeting, and I will be making a CD-ROM of this, sending it to the noticing agent, which is KCC. You'll be able to, in a couple of days, pull up and listen to the 341 meeting, I hope, at no cost to you and no wait, at the website, which is www.kccllc.net/ATPOG. You can go there now. You can see a lot of things about this case. It's really useful, but I have talked to them about putting the recording up because the only other alternative is for you to write to my office. I've got forms for you to fill out if you want to get a copy of it. We do not do transcripts. We will give you a digital recording on a CD-ROM, but you have to provide us with the CD-ROM on which we place it, and it must be in a sealed container. So a lot of times people have trouble with that. I also believe that if enough of you request the recording, it will take weeks and weeks for you to get it. So the easiest thing is for you to wait a couple of days, and it'll be up on the site. But if you need it for litigation purposes, feel free to take one of these forms with you, fill it out, and send it in with a CD-ROM on which we'll place the recording. But because we're making a recording, I need good, strong voices when you ask questions and when you testify, because all I have is this recording device. It's very sensitive, but it won't get someone who's got a soft voice in the back of the room. So I'd like you to, if you have a soft voice and you know it, and you know who you are, step forward and ask your question. I have appearance sheets posted at all of the doors. I hope everybody has put their name and who they represent or whether they represent themselves on the appearance sheets. We do need a full record of who was here. We'd have people on the phone. Right now we only have one person on the phone, but there may be more join us. I'm sorry if you would have liked to have called in. I didn't know we had that capability till like last Thursday. This room has been disconnected electronically for a number of weeks, so we got that capability back last week. The questioning protocol will also be, when I open it to questions, you state, every time you speak, you state who you represent. I am so-and-so, and I represent myself, and I have a question for, and you ask your question, so that we know who's talking if we need to make a transcript of this for trial purposes. The U.S. trustee's purpose here is to be the presiding officer here today, so I'll lead the discussion. In general, my office supervises the administration of Chapter 11 cases. This is a Chapter 11 reorganization case. We've been working with the debtor on various compliance items that we won't spend a lot of time today. That's banking, insurance, bonding, their structure, and I think all of that is relatively in order. So we won't spend a lot of time going over that today unless you have some particular questions. This is a reorganization case under Chapter 11 of the Bankruptcy Code. The primary objective is rehabilitation of the debtor by confirmation of a plan. So ultimately, the last question of the day will be, what is the plan? It is also my job to appoint an unsecured creditors committee. I have appointed an unsecured creditors committee. It is functional. Do I have any representatives of the Unsecured Creditors Committee here?
That's Vaughn from Board of Hedges on behalf of the committee.
All right, so Mr. Vaughn is here as local counsel for the committee. I also saw a hand.
Bush Lumberjack.
a Schlumberger representative is here. I have not formed an equity committee. An equity committee is an extraordinary remedy. It is under consideration, and there will be a hearing on that coming up, but it is under consideration. Won't be answering questions about that during this meeting. If you have questions about why a committee has or hasn't been formed, that's to be left until after the meeting. You're welcome to ask me, but I'm not under interrogation here, so that's not an issue that we're going to bring up. It's not something that the debtor gets to weigh in on. So I'd like to identify who's up here today and who's going to probably be answering some of your questions. So first we have counsel for the debtor from Mayor Brown. We have Charles Kelly. And Mr. Kelly, you've brought with you?
Christina Walsh from Mayor Brown also. And obviously the representative of the debtor will be Al Reese, Chief Financial Officer for ATP Oil and Gas Corp. Sitting on the other side of your chair, Ms. Holly, is Jim Latimer, who many of you may know was approved by the court last week or week and a half ago, I guess, as the Chief Restructuring Officer for ATP.
And I am going to put both Mr. Reese and Mr. Latimer under oath. You may ask Mr. Latimer questions, recognizing that he was only approved a week or so ago, but I think he's been on board for about 30 days or so, correct?
He commenced, I think, the day we filed his application. So the day his application was filed was the 14th of September. Thank you.
So his actual knowledge will only go back that far. He may have picked up knowledge, but his actual knowledge will only go back that far.
And in fairness, just for full disclosure, his consultation may have begun on the 14th because we reached out to him on specific issues, so it was probably sometime after he had a chance to really engage and digest some of the background materials.
All right. So, Mr. Reese, would you raise your right hand? Do you swear or affirm the testimony you give today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
And Mr. Latimer, do you swear or affirm the testimony you give today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes.
All right. A couple of things before we start. I said we did have an unsecured creditors committee. I am about to name a few replacements on the committee. So if you've got an unsecured claim on which you have not and cannot file liens, you may see me after the meeting, and we'll talk about it. That's for the unsecured creditors committee and not the equity committee. Proof of claim deadline. Want to make sure we get that out first, Mr. Kelly, because if you'll notice in the 341 notice that you got, specifically, we had not filled in the box deadline to file a proof of claim. And that's because this is a complex case, and normally the proof of claim deadline is set by motion. Mr. Kelly, what's the status of making a motion to set a proof of claim deadline?
We intend to file one probably within the next 10 days or less.
All right, so watch for that motion. And how do you know what date or deadline you're going to request?
I am anticipating we're going to be asking for something in the middle part of January.
So right now, mid-January, you need soft-spoken person, loud, like in court.
I'm expecting we'll be asking for something in the middle part of January.
So right now, there is no proof of claim deadline. If you know your claim, you should file a proof of claim so that you don't miss the deadline. But there will be a motion that will go out to all creditors, correct?
Correct.
Through the noticing service about the proof of claim deadline. Not every creditor needs to file a proof of claim. Rule 1111A of the Bankruptcy Code eliminates the need for every creditor and equity security holder to file a proof of claim or interest. But you're going to need to file a proof of claim if you are incorrectly listed in the schedules that are filed in any way. The name of your company, the address of your company. They put down the address and it's just a drop box in Illinois somewhere. And, you know, somebody picks it up for collection purposes, that might not be a good address. Name, address, amount, the nature of your claim. They've got you down as secured. You're really unsecured, they've got you as unsecured, you're really secured, then you need to file a proof of claim before the proof of claim deadline. It needs to be received by the bankruptcy court, And it gets filed through KCC, correct?
Correct.
In this particular case, if you go to the website, again, www.kccllc.net/ATPOG, there is a section for claims. You can file your claim that way, that you can also see claims that have been filed. It's a great thing. You need to get it on file with the bankruptcy court through the noticing agent. Can they bring it actually down to the bankruptcy court here?
I think it's supposed to be filed through KCC. I've seen some have been filed on the docket already.
I think KCC is going to do most of the sorting, and so you need to file it with KCC. And that's for creditors. Equity security holders, stockholders, are not creditors. They are owners of the company. They may file a proof of interest. I've actually never seen one of those, but I'm sure they're out there. If you proof of claim forms are available, I should have brought some down, and I will get some at a break. But proof of claim forms are available on the website, at the KCC website. They're available at the U.S. District Court website. So go to the website, get a proof of claim form, and fill it out. But the deadline has not run and has not even been set, and that's the important thing in this case. All right, so what we're going to do today is we do have full schedules and statement of financial affairs on file now. They will not be sent to everyone. They're too voluminous. You can get them. You can order them. And you can order them from the district court. You can also just download them from the website. So go to the website and take a look. But today we're going to be referencing those schedules. First, some general questions that I'd like to ask Mr. Reese. Mr. Reese, would you tell us? I want to go over the history and business of this company and why it filed for bankruptcy protection on August the 17th, 2012.
Okay, let me take the second part first, and that is why August the 17th. It was during the middle of, let me use that microphone or this one?
That's a recording microphone. This is an amplifying microphone.
Oh, okay. Got it. It was during the middle of July that we engaged Jefferies to assist us in finding a DIP lender, DIP, debtor in possession lender, because it became apparent middle to the end of July that that was probably the most likely course that we were going to be on. As we got into August, we had identified two or three potential DIP lenders. We actually had three. We ended up going down to two particular ones. And on August the 14th and 15th, through a board meeting and through working with the DIP lenders, we really came down to two lenders. The board made a decision on the 14th to go back to both lenders and try to hammer out the most appropriate term sheet that we could with each of the lenders. We did that. We came back to the board on August the 15th with the selection, and that was the selection of the group led by Credit Suisse as the administrator. And from August the 15th until August the 17th, we came very close to hammering out the, or not very close, we actually hammered out the term sheet. And the evening of the 16th, early morning on the 17th, we came to conclusion that with the DIP lenders on being able to file. It was at that point, once we had the DIP in place, we had the term sheet and the lenders agreed to advance under the term sheet, we made the decision to file on the 17th. So it all came down to having the DIP in place, DIP being the debtor in possession loan, in place and filing it on the 17th.
So let's go back historically. Why were you in that position in July that you needed to start looking for debtor in possession lending?
It's hard. You can't look at July by itself. I think you have to go back and say, what are the two or three items that put us in this position? Very seldom do you find a single point that said, this is the reason. In April of 2010, we put in place a new facility, credit facility. It was $1.5 billion of bonding. We did that on Monday, April the 19th. It paid off all of our old second lien and first lien debt that we had at the point. This was a brand new 5-year facility, very few financial covenants in it. It allowed us financially to be able to move forward on our new plan. What we had done at the early part of 2010 in January, we had uprighted the Titan at the Telemark location. In March, we put on location that first well that was going to go through the Titan. This was at our Telemark facility. And beginning in the second quarter, we were going to start bringing on 3 new wells at Telemark, one in the second quarter, one in the third quarter, and one in the fourth quarter. That coupled with 2 other wells that we were going to drill at our Gomez facility and 1 well that we were going to drill at our Canyon Express facility, those 6 wells were going to propel us into a production rate of somewhere around 50, maybe even 60,000 barrels per day. At the time, first quarter of 10, we were producing somewhere around the 20-something thousand barrel a day range. So this is the reason we were moving forward under that new financing plan, a very, very sharp uptick in production. On Tuesday, April the 20th of 2010, the Deepwater Horizon exploded. It sank on Thursday. Within 2 weeks, the government put in the first of 3 moratoriums. The first moratorium was a 30-day moratorium, and that one, there was very little complaint that I remember at all with the industry. It was simply trying to figure out what happened, because there was an issue that had occurred. Obviously, I think everyone, both within the industry, within government, within safety, wanted to find out what happened. Is this something that was going to or could happen at other locations? By the end of May, the government put in the first of 2 6-month moratoriums. The second one was ruled illegal, and a new one was replaced it in July. That is all the setup to say the 6 wells that I mentioned that we were going to bring on production during 2010 to help us basically grow the company into the new debt position that we had. Only one of those was on production by the end of 2010. By the time we got into the early part of 12, only 3 of the 6 wells were on production. As we sit here today, only 3 of the 6 were ever brought to production, and our production continues in the 20-ish thousand barrels a day range. I said earlier there's not one item that causes it. I'm not sitting here pointing a finger at the moratorium and saying that's the sole reason that we're here today. I'm a firm believer if you take the moratorium out of our history, we would not be sitting where we are today. But in addition to that, we did have an issue at our Telemark facility. The wells there did not perform the way we had hoped they were going to perform. I'm a financial guy, so I'm not, I know enough to make a comment like this. Hopefully there's no one going to challenge me too much on the details, because there are people that know more than I do on that. But 2 of the wells turned out they were in communication with each other, so they didn't have the production rate that we thought. We will be able to produce all the reserves there. It'll just be at a slower rate. In addition, we had a problem with a well that we were doing a recompletion on. What started out as a 20-day recompletion took about 120 days. During that 120-day period, just from the lack of production and the additional cost associated with that, that was about a $100 million swing during the first and the early part of the second quarter of 2012. We also had some financings that we were working on. We had 2 financings, one for our Octobuoy, which is a UK property. It was going to service the Cheviot property, which is in the UK North Sea. We have a Chinese bank that we've been working with to finance that. That's a $800-ish million facility. That was going to be a $500 to $600 million loan that was going to pay for all of the remaining cost of the Octobuoy to get it done and delivered in China. We expected to close that in July, August timeframe. In addition, and I think several of the people here may even know of the NPIs and overrides that we have. We had used those during 2010 and 2011 to finance the company, and it was also during the early part, middle part of 2012, we were working on another facility to where we were actually going to exchange one override for another. Both the Chinese financing and the additional financing with the override, each were going to put over $100 million into the company, and both were expected to close sometime in July and August. Unfortunately, neither of those closed during the July or August period of time. So what we found ourselves was production ramp had not occurred primarily because of the inability to drill as a result of the moratorium. That coupled with the underperformance at the Telemark location of the production rate there, not the reserves, but the production rate, and then the lack of financing in July and August. When both of those began to fall apart, we realized the only logical exit for us was going to be through Chapter 11.
Octobuoy did not close in July or August of 2011 or 2012?
2012. I'm sorry if I said 2011. I meant 2012.
Say what year? So that was 2011 or 2012.
2012.
It was supposed to close this year, and it didn't close.
That is correct.
So what's the status on the China Octobuoy?
We continue in discussion with the Chinese group. This is part of a subsidiary, and ATP UK is not a filing entity. It is a wholly owned subsidiary of the company. We're continuing to work with the Chinese banks, as well as the constructors over in China, to figure out a way to get the Octobuoy finished to where it can serve, preferably at Cheviot. If it's unable to serve at Cheviot, maybe it can serve at some other location around the world.
So that leads us to the discussion of your corporate structure. What are all of your subsidiaries? And then which ones filed and which ones didn't and why?
Okay. The only subsidiary that filed was ATP Oil and Gas Corporation. That is the U.S. Company. It is a Texas corporation. It is the parent. We have two operating subsidiaries that are wholly owned. One is ATP Oil and Gas UK. And please excuse me if I don't get the exact technical name correct. I may just refer to it as ATP UK. The next one is our ATP Netherlands subsidiary. Both of those are wholly owned subsidiaries. Underneath the Netherlands subsidiary, we have ATP East Med, and that company is the holding company for operations over in the Mediterranean. We have East Med, ATP East Med number one, which holds the licenses in Israel. We have ATP East Med number two, which has a bid into licenses in Cyprus. There is also an ATP East Med number three, but it is a dormant company at this point. In addition, I think there's a holding company somewhere involved in that, and I'm sorry, I don't know the exact location, but I think there is a holding company within, underneath the ATP Netherlands operations. We also have two subsidiary companies which are infrastructure companies. The first is ATP Titan LLC. This is the owner of the Titan, which is located at the Telemark location. This is the floating production facility that serves at Telemark. That is 100% owned by ATP Oil and Gas Corp through ATP Holdco, which is, again, another holding company in between ATP Corp and ATP Titan LLC. There's also ATP Infrastructure LP, which is the partnership that owns the ATP Innovator. And the Innovator serves as the floating production facility at our Gomez location. At ATP Infrastructure LP, there are three partners. There's ATP There's ATP GP, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of ATP Oil and Gas. We own 2%. We also have a 49% limited partnership ownership, and GE, through one of its subsidiaries, holds the other 49% in that particular partnership. There's ATP Energy, which is a dormant company. I think there's ATP Exploration, which is a dormant company, and I may have forgotten a couple other dormant companies, but I think in general that's the overall corporate structure. And again, ATP Oil and Gas U.S. was the only one that did filing.
And what was the theory on that? The others were solvent, the others couldn't file in Texas. What was the why did the others not file? Why didn't you put them all in?
I'll give a business answer. There are legal answers that I feel certain that others more qualified than I can give you some of the specifics on what you just asked. But from a business standpoint, it's my understanding that both in Israel and the Netherlands, as well as in the UK, they do not offer a Chapter 11 style of a filing. The only filings they have there basically are administration, what we would consider a Chapter 7 or maybe even a Chapter 7 light kind of situation. So in that particular case, there was no way to do a restructuring organization within either of those areas. In addition to that, the debts of the intercompany subsidiaries are all held by ATP Oil and Gas, so there was no pressure from the oil and gas company into the subsidiaries. So they had no pressure forcing them under a debt obligation. There are payables within both, and those payables are trying to be addressed by each of the subsidiaries right now.
Are those subsidiaries obligors under the first or second lien? Are either of those entities obligors under the first or second lien?
No.
And Mr. Kelly, while none of the subs were filed on the first day, and except Mr. Reese's answer about his general answer about inability to reorganize in other countries, is there any consideration today about filing the other subsidiaries through a Chapter 15 here in Texas?
We are continuing to evaluate that, and there is consideration. We have been working with the creditors for the ATP East Med, which has got a shorter time frame. There is approximately, 38 or $40 million in debt owed to creditors for drilling the Shimshon well off the coast of Israel for ATP East Med. Given credits due the company from the VAT and other contributions from other owners, the company's share of that obligation is approximately $25 million, give or take. I'm using round numbers that's been conveyed to me from the company. There are creditors for that who have initiated various types of actions in the Israeli courts, from the equivalent of leaning up the company's interests on those offshore licenses to actually proceedings asking for an administrative proceeding. We are working with those creditors because the company has identified a purchaser of those assets, a company called Moncrief. The Moncrief transaction was the subject of an 8K filed by the company a couple weeks ago. It was put together and attached to a responsive pleading filed in the Israeli administrative proceedings, and in which the transaction contemplates that the purchaser would pay off the creditors with one tranche of funds, and with a second tranche of funds would purchase the company's interest in those fields, which is approximately a 35 to 40% interest, and I'll explain, for the cost of what the company has into it. The cost of development costs that the company has paid in those fields is approximately $30+ million.
Either set of 30.
So the transaction cost roughly contemplates the company's third-party creditors will be paid and it'll be reimbursed its transaction costs in sale for its working interests and its rights to those license. There are some issues that have to be worked out with the Ministry of Energy by this purchaser. It has to qualify as an operator to take over these fields. Because the transaction, the fields, strike that back up a second. Because of the way the Department or Ministry of Energy in Israel required the structure, ATP East Med has a 35% working interest in these licenses. ATP Oil and Gas Corp, the debtor, has a 5% working interest in these licenses. So the transactions will require some combination of a sale and conveyance by both the debtor and these entities in order to conclude that transaction. There are conditions precedent to those transactions, which means we're going to have to get appropriate bankruptcy court approvals, and we're going to have to, and the company will have to secure appropriate approvals from the Israeli courts. We think, although the deal is structured that way, and we know Moncrief is working towards that, and we hope they're successful in that, if other parties are interested, I expect Judge Isger will require some form of topping procedures, and we'll have to respect that because that will be part of the bankruptcy court process. But we have filed the Moncrief papers. It's got about a 90-day option to it to allow Moncrief to try to get the approvals it needs from the Israeli government. And that is why, if, as we look at that in working with Moncrief, if it makes sense to put it in a Chapter 15 and working with the creditors to effectuate that transaction, we will do so. But that's sort of, it, because it's a pending transaction, we want to work with the Purchasers Council to figure out their comfort level and how they want to deal with that. With respect to ATP UK, while there is technically an ability to do a type of restructuring in the UK, we've been advised by UK counsel that's never been undertaken, and that everything is essentially a liquidation type proceeding. Because there is the potential to capture some equity for those entities, there are some valuable licenses off the coast of England that many companies are interested in. And because at the status of construction of the Octobuoy right now, which I better let Al testify to, but it's my general understanding that the whole of the Octobuoy is being constructed in the Costco facility in China, along with what are loosely called the topside portions that take care of the utility functions, and that the process topsides for that are being constructed in Louisiana by Blue Water?
Gulf Island.
On Gulf Island, excuse me, by Gulf Island. That when they were married together, they would create a very nice state-of-the-art floating facility. However, the company lacks the cash to be able to complete that. And so if there is a way to have a third party come in and complete that through a sale leaseback type structure, the company is exploring all of those options currently. Because of the complexities of the laws and where these things are, the significant construction is occurring in China, the company has been monitoring carefully when it needs to go to an administrative proceeding, but would prefer not to, to effectuate a transaction so it can capture value. If it's successful, there is real value to capture in the equity it may own in the whole, and the company is focused intently on that. And as we, if the company is successful in putting some transactions together and is prepared to proceed with those, we will evaluate whether we need to do those inside or outside of a proceeding. And that's the two foreign affiliates. The two domestic affiliates, I don't think Al testified to yet, but I can. It's more of a legal answer. The Titan is put into a special entity called ATP Titan Holdco, which holds the ATP Titan LP, which holds the Titan. ATP Titan LP is the borrower under a credit facility led by Beal Bank. I think the outstanding payables on that is approximately $305 million. I believe the company thinks there is equity value in the Titan based upon the cost and the accounting of the value of the Titan. It is a reusable platform. It can be towed to a different facility. It can be sold. A lot of things can happen to it. The company believes there is several hundred million dollars at least in equity value in that entity. But that entity was structured by Beal in order to loan directly to that entity as a bankruptcy remote vehicle, and they have control and consent rights as to whether ATP Titan Holdco can file, and the company did not control the destiny of whether it wanted to put that into a filing, so it has remained outside of a filing. ATP Innovator is held in the partnership that Mr. Reese just testified to, which are indirect subsidiaries owned by a company called ATP Holdco. There's ATP Titan Holdco and ATP Holdco. Holdco holds the partnerships that own the innovator. When GE invested in that, GE required that those entities be made as bankruptcy remote entities in which its consent rights are required. And so the infrastructure entities were not able to be filed by ATP Oil and Gas at its own discretion, so those remain outside bankruptcy for the time being.
That was a lot of information. I think it was pretty well summarized. But I want to take a break here, not a break from the action, but and let people ask some questions if they have questions. For a lot of that came from Mr. Kelly rather than Mr. Reese. And you might also want to ask the CRO questions about that. Does anybody have a question about the corporate structure, why we're here, why subsidiaries aren't here? If you do, yes, sir. Loud voice.
Aaron, on behalf of Circle Second Lien Holdings Ad Hoc Committee. With respect to the UK operations, and I guess it's probably Mr. Reese, could you just generally describe what the assets are? I think I understand what they are. Would you just generally describe what they are, what the liabilities are, and hopefully you can give dollar amounts and break that down between intercompany and third-party payables, if you would, please.
Yes, within ATP UK, I'll break the assets into three basic classes. The first is producing assets. These are in the Southern Gas Basin. It would be facilities or properties known as Winlock, Tors, and Helvellyn. All three of these are gas. They are essentially 100% gas. Helvellyn produces seasonally. It's typically off in the summer and on in the wintertime. There is some development still to be made at the Tors facility, but otherwise those three properties are essentially proof-producing properties. There are two other locations we have. One is called Skipper, and the other is Blythe. Both of these are undeveloped properties. We are the operator of both. We have a 50% interest in both. And I believe these are both gas and oil developments. I could be corrected. One may be a gas only, but I know one of them, at least one of them, has an oil leg to it. The larger property, both in terms of reserves and PV-10 value, would be Cheviot. This is located in the northern part of the North Sea. This is a completely undeveloped property. It did produce from 1992 to 1996. We acquired this property, I believe it was 2003 or 2004. Cheviot, really, I think you have to view as two separate properties. One is the floating infrastructure, which is the octobuoy that we've talked about. To expand a little bit on what Charles said, the hull is being constructed in China at Costco's yard. Hull is 90-plus percent complete. We have pictures of the hull that we have disclosed before these, both in public as well as investor presentations. The top sides are broken into two pieces. One is the utility module, the second is the process module. The utility module is being built by Costco in China. It is partially completed at this point. The process module is being built by Gulf Islands Yard in I believe it's Houma, Louisiana. Blue Water, a U.S. company based here in Houston, is the primary contractor for us for the octobuoy. The Cheviot reserves themselves, this is a field known as the Emerald Field until we changed the name of it after acquisition. This is a development that we hope to utilize the octobuoy at. It has, if memory serves me correct, about 39 million barrels of proved and probable reserves at this location. It's a billion-dollar development based on our PV-10 from our 12/31/11 reserve report. This is the property that we're trying to maintain value on in the UK. So that, from an asset standpoint, that kind of lays out all of the properties. The debt there is primarily intercompany, other than the payables. Intercompany debt, and Harry, I know you wanted a precise number. It's in the filings. It's about $600-ish million of intercompany debt between ATP Corp and ATP UK. There is a small amount, and I'm sorry I don't remember the exact number, between ATP and ATP Netherlands. It's a small intercompany payable there. The payables themselves relating to the octobuoy at this point are about $160 or $170 million. All of those are at the ATP UK level. ATP Oil and Gas Corp does guarantee some of those payables. I think there are three or four vendors where there's a parent guarantee for that. So I think that addressed all of your issues, both the asset side as well as the other side.
Let me ask you one follow-up question. You had Terry Perrin on behalf of the ad hoc note holders committee and the second lien holders. What would be the estimated cost to complete the Octobuoy project? You mentioned there's one. I'm trying to get kind of an all-in number. It's $160 to $170 million, you're saying. It's outstanding. What would be the bogey to get to completion?
I believe the to be spent after that is probably in the range of around $150 to $200 million will get you a completed unit in China. Now, you have to get that unit from China over to the UK. That is not a cheap tow. It's put on two different boats provided by Dockwise. I mean, just the towing and installation is a $100 million tap just to get it from China over that. And you also have to get the top sides from here over to China so it can be married up there before it's disassembled and taken across.
Did the $150 million or $160 million number you gave, did that include the cost to complete the was that the payable to Costco and the payable to Blue Water, or just the payable to Costco?
Good point. The $150, $160 million number, that is just the payables primarily associated with the topsides being built in Louisiana. Costco is currently owed, because they're carrying a lot of the construction cost on both the hull as well as the topsides, they are currently owed slightly in excess of $110 million. By the time that they finish the topsides and they finish the hull, that number will grow to just over $200 million. I think it's about $225 million.
Other questions about the corporate structure, why we're here? Yes, sir, your name?
Good morning, Benjamin Cadden for Warrior Energy and Superior Energy. I wanted to ask a quick question about the ATP UK. You said there was 650, I think the number was 663, in intercompany debt with ATP UK.
Is that the number on the schedule?
That's the number from the schedule I'm looking at.
Fine, I knew it was 600 and something. I didn't look back.
What is that number made up of? I mean, what is the basis for that receivable? And do you feel it's collectible, and do you have any sort of security as between the companies to secure that debt?
No, it is an unsecured advance. It would be made up primarily of advances from ATP Oil and Gas Corp to ATP UK. The interest portion would be additive to that. I don't have a breakdown as to exactly what makes up the advances and what makes up the interest.
You said it's unsecured?
Yes, it is an unsecured note.
And is that payment of the debts that you talked about earlier being partially guaranteed by the debtor? I guess what I'm trying to get to is Schedule H lists co-debtors, debts on which the debtor is a co-debtor with another entity. To the extent that the debtor is guarantor of the ATP UK debt, how can I figure out what portion they're guarantor of, what that amount is?
I would have to refer to that schedule to see if it is listed under there as a contingent debt or not. We have retained the right to amend these schedules, and when we get into some other questions, I already know a couple of things that need to be amended. If it is not included on the schedule now, it is certainly something that we would want to include on the schedule as a potential contingent liability.
All right, and again, Ben Cadden, kind of a generic question. You understand, sir, that the schedules are signed under penalty of perjury, and you're the signatory, correct?
Yes, I understand that.
All right. And so I'm looking at the first page of the global notes that says basically, here, let me just read it so that I won't just quote it. Let's see. In reviewing and signing schedules, the statement Albert Reese Jr. necessarily relied upon efforts, has not and could not have personally verified the accuracy of each statement and representation included in the schedule or statement, including but not limited to, etc. I guess my question is, if you're on the one hand signing the schedules under penalty of perjury, on the other hand making this caveat that you're really not sure and you relied on other people, can we rely that these are true and correct?
I think the answer to that, from a business standpoint, and there may be a legal standpoint that would have either a different answer or confirm it. Clearly, we're looking at well over 100 pages of information. Some of this information is clearly very detailed, very, very precise in what it is doing. We are a multi-billion dollar operation. I do not make every journal entry. I do not process every check. I do not process every deposit that we make. And I clearly have to rely on a lot of accounting personnel, a lot of legal personnel. The people sitting beside me here obviously have helped prepare all of these schedules. I think what this is trying to say is, under my signature, yes, I have reviewed this, and I will tell you, I reviewed every page that was in here prior to signing. I did find some items that I questioned, and those items were addressed. Either no, they addressed it, or yes, you're right, Al, thank you for looking at it. So I have gone through that. With that said, I already know of a few other items that need to be changed, need to be updated. So within the parameters of these true and correct, yes, they probably are, I think, true and correct. Also with the caveat of realizing that these are going to have to be updated at various times just to get them more and more accurate.
Were there specific areas that gave you greater pause? I mean, I'm just trying to get a feeling if there's sections that you basically said, look, I'm not completely unfamiliar with that type of structure, debt, asset, liability, et cetera. I'm going to rely entirely on somebody else, and where are your amendments going to be coming, if you know?
I don't know exactly where all of the amendments will be coming from. I mean, there are 52 pages, I think, of leases and contracts and things of that nature. I have a lot to do with that, but I don't have a whole lot to do with that area. I'm relying very heavily upon our land department, our attorneys that do that. Clearly, from the check writing and accounting, I'm a little more familiar with that. So those I have a more working knowledge of being able to either challenge or question or things of that nature. Certainly, there are payments in here. My name is listed as both, you know, receiving payments and things of that nature. I've got a pretty good idea of how much money I've received or paid or whatever, so I've got a good idea as to those. There's a pretty intimate knowledge of, yeah, that's how much money I got, and I remember that particular check.
I will make another observation. Obviously, as the CFO for the company, he has certain signatory responsibility for documents filed with the SEC, which includes reporting on operational issues, which clearly aren't his, you know, expertise, but as an officer of the company, he obtains information from many people within the company. He is probably the broadest based knowledge in the company and the most logical signatory for the statement of financial affairs and for the schedules. But clearly, I think it's readily recognized that some of the information contained in there comes from outside his department and division. But he is probably the most qualified to testify as to a lot of these items. There are some things that there will be other people in the company who will have greater knowledge, but Al can cover most of the subjects in the schedules and statement of financial affairs.
You had a question, sir?
Yes, Clint Snow of Gardner Wind School. My firm represents a number of AGP's creditors, Drillquip.
Real loud.
Apache Corporation, Drillquip, a number of overriding royalty interest holders, and Quail Tools called Pete. I hope you won't have to repeat all those again. I'll just say Clint Snow. I'd like to take us back to ATP East Med and your operations in Israel. Drillquip, I believe, is owed approximately $80,000 in connection with the Shimshon project, and it's wondering about the state of affairs over there in Israel. It's concerned about licenses that have been suspended. I'd like to get a little bit more detail about the affairs in Israel and what's going on over there right now. I know Mr. Kelly went through the Israel operations fairly quickly, and quite frankly, I didn't catch them all.
Certainly. Israel, or the East Med operations, is a work in progress right now, literally a work in progress. We have, as Mr. Kelly mentioned, entered into an agreement to sell our licenses to a company out of Fort Worth called Moncrief. This is the company that Mr. Kelly mentioned.
Sir, would you spell that for me, please?
I believe it is M-O-N-T-C-R-I-E-F.
No T. Moncrief.
Okay, Moncrief. I was close.
And it's out of where?
Fort Worth. There was an 8K filed a couple of weeks ago that has the agreement actually attached to it. So all of my comments here I'm going to relate as a memory from what's in there, and please refer to that for the actual the detail. Essentially, the agreement would say this. Moncrief will acquire ATP East Med's interest in the Shimshon license and two other licenses that we have there called East and West Daniel. Moncrief will reimburse ATP East Med, it's actually East Med number one, for all of its payments that it has made, ATP East Med number one has made relating to the Shimshon well, the acquisition and drilling. In addition to that, Moncrief will assume responsibility for all the remaining payables associated with that action. So that's what we have entered into. As Mr. Kelly mentioned, ATP Oil and Gas Corp. has a 5% interest in that well, in the Shimshon license. This is an asset of the estate. One of the things that is required to perfect the transfer from ATP East Med number one to Moncrief is concurrence by the bankruptcy court here in Texas for that transfer. That's both a general concurrence of what we're doing with one of the subsidiary assets, as well as how to address the 5% direct ownership that ATP Oil and Gas Corp., the debtor, has in that particular well. So that's the current structure of what we have. Two entities, Schlumberger and Frank's Casing, have filed actions against ATP East Med, number one in Israel. As such, there is a hearing that is scheduled this week. I believe it may be next week. I'm not exactly sure on the timing. And that particular decision will decide who will be the administrator for ATP East Med number one. If what we have proposed is that there's an ATP administrator, I think, coupled with a Schlumberger administrator to take that, and if that's the case, we will try to proceed down the route of closing out the Moncrief. If another administrator is formed, there's always the possibility that we will not be successful and we will not get any of the money returned to us for the amount that we've already been spent. That's the reason I say it's really a work in progress. The $80,000 that you're owed, I can assure you at this point, it will not come out of ATP Oil and Gas Corp. We are prohibited from making any advances to either the UK, any of our foreign operations that relate to capital expenditures. We do have the ability to make an advance for G&A, and this is a specified amount that we're able to make periodically under certain conditions. I don't know if that's a complete answer, but that's the answer as I know it right now.
The contract with Moncrief that was filed with the Israeli court and was attached to the 8K is a contract between Moncrief and ATP East Med 1. ATP Oil and Gas Corp. is not a signatory to that. Obviously, if the conditions are going to go forward, then we will have to negotiate an agreement that will include the debtor as a signatory. But it is not currently a signatory to that document, but it is clear from the conditions precedent that that transaction will require the debtor to sell its 5% in the field as part of that transaction to get it to completion.
One follow-up question on that. Jerry Perry on behalf of the ad hoc committee. Is the 5% that's owned by ATP baked into the option agreement such that there's that value allocated to ATP's, the debtor's portion of the working interest?
It right now it is only stated as a condition precedent. There are some complications there, which I'm happy to explain, but is a condition precedent that ATP will sell its portion, but ATP Oil and Gas Corp, the debtor, has not itself engaged in negotiations to figure out that allocation. But there will be an allocation based on combination of debts owed. I'm not sure, as I sit here now, whether ATP Oil and Gas Corp has paid its full ride on its 5% yet, but obviously that will have to be addressed in the allocation. But there will be an allocation for that. And I believe that as the proceeds come in, it is contemplated that the proceeds will have to be distributed in accordance with either any intracompany debt that ATP East Med may owe to its affiliates or via equity distributions to other affiliates and to allow them to satisfy their intracompany obligations.
So there will not be additional consideration for the 5%. It's included within the option price.
It is included within the total package price, and it will be given its allocated share of whatever the cost into it would be for its interest. Correct. Sorry, I didn't fully understand your question.
Question back there.
Garner Griggs, represent DockWise. I want to speak about the ATP UK again. You mentioned that you're discussing further financing in China. Is that ongoing at this time?
Yes, it is.
And can you give us the progress of that and what's expected?
I think the progress really hinges on two things. One, it hinges on the ability to have a financing for the Octobuoy, being able to take it all the way through construction in China. The second is having a home for the Octobuoy after it is constructed. We would like to be able to use it in the Cheviot project for ATP UK. To do that, we have to get financing for ATP UK. Again, the DIP lending does not allow any money being able to be used in our foreign operations. So we would have to figure out a way to be able to use it and be able to get capital into ATP UK. The second alternative would be to find a buyer for the Octobuoy and be able to use it somewhere else in the world. It can be used in lots of different places. It will service anywhere from water depths of about 500 feet all the way to 9,500 feet. It has the ability to store oil on it, and it's a processing facility, so it could be used by someone else.
And are you soliciting it for sale at this time, and what's the progress of that if you are?
We are talking with various entities about potentially doing that. I do not know who all we're talking to about that, but I know we have contacted others outside ATP UK to be a purchaser for the Octobuoy. No, not at this point, other than Jefferies. Jefferies is well attuned to all of the assets that we have. It's one of the reasons we selected Jefferies. It's because of their worldwide presence.
The ATP debt that's in the UK, of which ATP debtor is co-guarantor, co-debtor, how much is that? What's the ATP UK debt?
To the lender, I'm sorry.
The
only intercompany debt is, the only debt per se that ATP UK has other than payables would be with ATP Oil and Gas. I said it was about 600 and something million. He corrected me, 663 or whatever the number. It's in the schedule, whatever the schedule says.
Within your debt structure, there's no pledge or guarantee, no pledge of ATP UK stock.
Within the current structure, the DIP loan does have a pledge of 65% of the outstanding shares of ATP UK.
I'd like to circle back now to the United States. We've gone for about an hour. Do either you guys need a break? Can we go forward to the schedule?
I'm fine. It's up to you.
I'm fine right now.
Okay. I'd like to circle back. If you have any other questions, we may be able to get back to it. We have to handle our own debtor. Would you tell us, Mr. Reese, when you first filed, you stated in court that headquarters were here in Houston, about 60 employees. Is that still the same? Have you added any employees?
We have not added. We have not added any employees. As of yesterday, I think we have had five resignations.
and those resignations in areas that would cripple the company?
Not at this point, but when you have a company, as I'll use the terms, as small as ours, every individual is someone that is doing something. We do not have the luxury of having eight people do five people's worth of work. So I think what you will see us over the next several weeks and months is we will try to either reallocate, and I feel certain we're going to have to start bringing people in on a contract basis if resignations continue.
Okay, so you have approximately 55 people now?
That's about right.
For what it's worth, the management is currently preparing a proposed CERP and KEEP program that we will be filing a motion on to avoid further loss of employees, but I thought I would mention that that's coming since Mr. Reese's testimony dovetails into that.
Thank you for mentioning that. We'll get ready. Okay. So the main thing that we've been concerned about before we go to turn to the schedule specifically so far is the Clipper. And I want you to bring us up to date on the status of the Clipper project and the pipe laying and any issues we still have with Tech Deep and laying the pipe.
Talked with our engineer yesterday, expecting this to be one of the topics. And essentially everything that can be put on the bottom of the floor, the bottom of the ocean, is in place. There are two what's referred to as jumpers that still need to be installed. The jumper, one that goes at each end of the pipe, one will run from the wellhead to one end of the pipe, and the other runs from the other end of the pipe to the flexible riser that is coming down from the Murphy platform called Front Runner. Most, almost all, but certainly most of the equipment requiring installation on the Murphy platform is done at this point. So everything seems to be moving ahead fairly rapidly now that we've gotten the payment systems worked out. That was causing some delay, just making sure everyone could get paid and under what time frame. We're still on schedule at this point for a mid-December startup for that particular project. So hopefully we're about 2 months away from being able to have first oil and first gas.
Let me just add, are the umbilicals in place? They're supposed to go in later this month.
I think that's the only piece
of hardware that hasn't gone in is the umbilicals, which are supposed to be put out there on the Chickasaw later this month. Just for a clarification.
You may know more than I do on that particular point.
From a pipeline standpoint, his testimony answered with respect to Technip, all of the hardware is on the ground.
Yes.
There is an important component, which I can't, even as an engineer, explain exactly how it works, but it's these umbilicals that are to be set in place later in the month of October. Another Technip ship, I believe, called the Chickasaw or something to that effect, is supposed to put that in place later in the month. I think that may be the last piece of physical hardware to go underneath the surface of the water. I can see Blue Waters Council nodding, so I think that's...
So mid-December is the now projected startup on the Clipper?
Yes.
And to the best of your knowledge and belief, you're on track at this moment?
At this, based on what I heard yesterday, we're on track for a mid-December startup.
And what is, ask your counsel, what is the drop dead under the financing?
End of the month of December. As we indicated in court, if Murphy gives us greater access and beds, we can increase the crews on the top side, which is our critical path, and we might be able to have it done sooner than the 15th. But I think for budgeting and for calendaring purposes, we're targeting the 15th since we don't control whether we will get those additional beds.
Anybody have any questions about the Clipper project? Okay. So, you had mentioned, Mr. Reese, that there were, when you were looking over the schedule, you had found a number of areas that, or some areas, that needed amendments, deletions, or additions. So, let me ask you the general question. Are there any, taking first the schedules, are there any...
Schedules.
Well, we'll do the Statement of Financial Affairs then, first. You had it on top. Statement of Financial Affairs. What additions, what if any, additions, deletions, or corrections need to be made in an amended schedule? Statement of Financial Affairs.
To answer your question completely, I don't have all of the information. What I do know is there were a few areas that I know will require amendments. I can talk to those, but to say this is a complete and 100% list of everything that is going to be corrected, I do not have that information at this point.
Well, we don't expect you to have a complete list.
Okay.
It'll need to be complete when you sign it again under penalty
that,
of perjury.
That is
right
correct.
Right now, let's start with just
identifying the issues.
Right.
Identifying the issues you've identified.
What do you know needs review? And
well,
then we'll ask some specific questions.
For one, is SOFA number two, which is income other than from operations of business, which is primarily derivative income and interest income. In reviewing this, we noted that we left off the 2011 interest income. While I also know that the $696,000 shown as 2010 is a consolidated interest income and not ATP oil and gas, the debtor income only. Most of the interest income that is shown on here and will be shown on the future schedules is intercompany interest. So from that standpoint, that needs to be corrected. This is just one of the corrections that I'm aware of on this particular schedule.
Well, let's look at number two. I had some questions about number two. So
okay.
What was the source of the interest income?
The source of the interest income is almost all intercompany income. There could have been, and there was, a minor amount of income that is actually earned interest income that we would have, but this is all during a period when interest rates were either side of 1%, so there's not a whole lot of true cash paid interest income.
Okay, and the derivatives loss?
Derivative income and loss, this is both realized loss as well as unrealized loss. One of the major portions of the January 1 to the August 16th, 2012, there was a $52 million closeout of hedges by Macquarie. During this period of time, we had already booked about 20-something million dollars of loss for that. So there was a net, and we had some gains during this period of time. So that was the derivative loss. Derivative income during 2011, again, was both realized as well as unrealized.
And then gain on disposal of properties in 2010 and 2011. First question, was there any disposal of properties in 2012 prior to filing?
Not that I am aware of.
And when you're talking about gain on disposal of properties, what properties did you dispose of in, if you recall, in 2010?
In 2010, we sold, there were two items here. As a sidebar, we are primarily a development company. We don't do a whole lot of true exploration. In both 2011 and in 2010, we sold the deep rights. These would be exploration rights below certain depths to Shell. And in each case, since we have nothing allocated to cost-wise allocated to the exploration rights, everything we receive for that is taken straight to income because there's no allocation of cost for that. So in both 2011 and 2010, we had sale of deep rights to Shell. Also in 2010, we did an exchange with Newfield. We exchanged our interest in Mississippi Canyon 800 for an increased interest in Mississippi Canyon 754 and Newfield's interest in Mississippi Canyon 710. While this was a non-cash exchange, simply because of accounting and allocations, we did record a small gain on that particular transaction.
So those are my questions with regard to number two. So does anybody have any questions with regard to Statement of Financial Affairs number one or number two? Okay, moving on to number three, Mr. Reed. First up, I'm looking over number three. Did you see any amendments, deletions, or additions you need to make in that skip?
I do know of one grouping that we're going to have, and this was in a question that you had asked. On page 3, you'll see a payment to Gerald W. Schleif and Candace R. Schleif. I'll try to not get in too much detail, but practically all of the payments that have a 7/31/2012 date relate to an overriding royalty interest or net profits interest that we sold to Guggenheim in January of 2010. There were, I believe, 16 holders that are part of that. Citicorp is the distribution agent for the funds that are received on that. I say all of that as a setup to what I'm getting ready to say. What we found out was when we do this, we have to record the interest to the various individual owners. In this case, Jerry Schleif is, Jerry and Candy are one of the override holders within the Guggenheim override. We book that, and then we turn right around and do a closing entry that removes that. We never actually send them a check. Instead, we send a check to Citicorp, and Citicorp makes the distribution. So while it is shown as a distribution on this page, it was not actually a distribution to Jerry or Candy Schleif, and there are several others that you can look through here, and those that would show a payment on or about seven or on July the 31st, those will be coming off of the next one. What will go on there will be an actual check to Citicorp for the total amount of that distribution. So that's one item that I do know will be changing on that particular description.
Okay. Would it be the same explanation? When he said questions I asked, I had sent a list of questions of be prepared to answer these. So that's what he's talking about. So I'd asked about the Schleifs.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same situation with David Weber and Davis Radcliffe? Page
2
of
9. Page 2 of 9. David Weber, I did check because you had asked that one. No, David Weber is a true overriding, when I say true, it is a perpetual overriding royalty interest. This would be an interest that was retained by an original owner of one of the properties that we have. And so that's an actual just overriding royalty interest distribution. I did not check David Ratcliffe.
Davis Ratcliffe.
But by looking at the dates and looking at the amounts, I'll go out on a limb and say it seems to be very similar to what we had done for David Weber. So that would be a perpetual overriding royalty interest.
On the next page, Hans Reichforst received two.
Yes, Hans Reichforst. He had, on a contract basis, had done some international business development work for us. And those are two payments that we would have made to him.
Anybody have any other questions about 3A or B before we move to 3C, insiders? On the insiders, my question is, there seems to be a large payment to a number of the insiders on April the 10th, 2012.
Yes. That is the amount paid to our directors, all of those, and I did specifically check the April 10th payments, $30,000. I think two of the directors, one got $40,000 and one, I believe, got $50,000. Those are their annual directors' fees of $30,000, the one that got $40,000 and the one that got $50,000. Those are chairmen of committees, and they would have gotten an additional amount for that.
I think you've answered some questions about payments to. Do we have any other questions about payments to the affiliates or payments to any of the insiders? Statement of Financial Affairs 3C. Anybody have any questions? All right. Any changes you know that need to be made as regards to SOFA 3?
3C?
A, B, or C?
I do not have anything noted that I know that we will be making changes, but please understand there is a possibility that changes may occur I'm not aware of yet.
All right. Statement of Financial Affairs number 4, or suits and lawsuits. My only question there is, it says incidents of noncompliance halfway down the chart, environmental, with the Bureau of Environmental Enforcement, and you filed an appeal with Bessie. So what was that in relation to?
This particular one took place at the ATP Innovator. Essentially, there was a piece of equipment that apparently was not installed correctly. We are currently investigating that with Bessie for cooperation there to figure out what was the reason and what was the implication of that piece of equipment not being installed properly.
And the Bison litigation, which is the first one on night number 4, summary order confirming ATP's position. Is that set? The case has stayed, but it's not a final order. The Bison prevailed at the Court of Appeals. No. The Court of Appeals entered a summary order confirming ATP's position. Case will go back to the trial court. So ATP prevailed on that one?
Let me answer this from a business standpoint, and I will defer to the lawyers for some of the more specifics.
I ask because Bison's one of the 20 largest unsecured creditors.
Yes. This was a case brought by Bison against ATP. The basis of the case was Bison had introduced ATP to Credit Suisse during the early part of 2004. We ended up, and for that we paid Bison a fee for introduction, working with us on getting that particular transaction done. From 2004 through the filing of the Bison case originally, we had done some 20-something deals with Bison, or excuse me, with Credit Suisse. Many had been at debt and equity and preferreds and exchanges and things of that. Bison took a position shortly before statute of limitations expired that even though we had not involved them with any of those cases during the 5 or 6 year period, that they wanted to get a fee collected on every one of those transactions. That would have added to well over $100 million in just fees associated with that. What happened was at the court, it was determined that since we had done one transaction within a one-year period from the time of entering into that engagement with Bison, they were awarded a fee for that particular transaction, and the other 19 or 20, however many it was, were dismissed. Bison appealed that ruling, and as far as I know, the judge had ruled on that, and I think the ball is back in Bison's court to whether they wanted a further appeal, and that's when we filed. I can be corrected on the legalities of a little of that, but in business-wise, that's kind of the case.
So do there need to be any changes, additions, or deletions or corrections on number 4?
I'm not aware of any on this particular page.
My next question, it doesn't come until Statement of Financial Affairs number 16. So first, between 4 and 16. Are there any changes, additions, corrections, deletions you need to make in the Statement of Financial Affairs that you've already recognized?
A note on SOFA 9, payments related to debt counseling or bankruptcy. Thompson and Knight is listed. This was a payment to Thompson and Knight, but it was not related to debt counseling or bankruptcy.
All right.
So.
Anything else up to 16? Anybody else up to 16?
No. I do not have a 16.
So the 16 is the citation. No, it's back in your questions. It's not a, you don't have a separate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Statement of Affairs, Financial Affairs number 16, I believe, is the regulatory.
This is the number 17? Okay, I'm with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Environmental information?
Yeah, okay. 17,
got it.
Environmental.
Got it.
17, environmental. Alford of the ATP innovator. Is that what you've described before?
That's exactly what I just mentioned.
All right. My next questions are at number 23 about withdrawals and fees. Does anybody have any other questions before SOFA number 23? Yes, sir.
Yes, Philip, I can go to the town. I wanted to ask, there was a letter, and I think it's environmental or compliance, and I know you said you didn't want to talk about bonds, but I don't know how else to ask. There was a letter from BOEM asking for $84 million in security or bonds of that nature, and there was supposed to be some follow-up letters both from the company to BOEM in response and from BOEM on other properties. And I was wondering if you could provide an update on the communications both to and from BOEM with regard to flooding abandonment and bonding on the Gulf Shore.
Certainly, if I can make a slight correction, you said an $84 million in the letter. The letter actually was like 70, I think it was $70 million. We have within our DIP budget $84.9 million. That may be where you're getting the 84. I'm not questioning it, but just trying to get the record a little more accurate. Again, let me give you the high level where we are. As we went into the plan within the DIP budget, we have two items that are to address. It's what's referred to, it's commonly referred to as idle iron or abandonments or things of that nature. We selected an 18-month period for the bankruptcy. We certainly hope to be out sooner than that, but that is what is listed within the DIP budget. And we have right around $35 million associated with actual abandonments that we will be making during this 18-month period. This is actual going out, physically abandoning either a pipeline or property or platform or something. In addition to that, we have around $50 million set aside to address any bonding items that we may have with the government. And specifically on bonding, before we went in, we were what's referred to as an exempt entity within the BOEM, meaning that we did not have to post bonds. Obviously, with the Chapter 11 filing, that has now come into question. But we put within the DIP budget $50 million for that. We have since received a letter. Actually, there have been a couple of letters going back and forth. The most recent one was a request by the BOEM to address sooner than what we had suggested. We had addressed suggestion in a previous filing by the end of this year. Essentially, we would address the bonding. They want us to address it sooner than that. They have cited about $70 million associated with bonding that they want us to address. We are currently going through, again, this is real time. We've had meetings this week on it, trying to figure out of the $70 million, how much of that is already addressed in the 30-something, 35-ish million dollars of actual abandonment we're going to be doing, how much of that needs to be bonded, how much of that is within the 18-month period, how much is without the 18-month period. There's a meeting set sometime later this week with the BOEM to continue this dialogue. Obviously, this is a work in progress, and as things progress, we will clearly keep the court informed on Thursdays as to what's happening, and when appropriate and have a definitive decision, we will certainly report that to everyone.
to further,
just follow up.
Sorry.
Were there other properties beyond the ones that were in the original letter that have now been covered by request by the BOEM?
The $70 million that I mentioned addresses, I think, most of our properties. They are trying to address, I'll just say, the Titan and the Innovator. Both of these are the floating production facilities that are designed to be reused. They are not designed to be abandoned. And I think that's from a business standpoint, one of the issues that we're dealing with on the BOEM, because typically the most platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, in fact, all up to now, have been either abandoned in place or because they're designed to be consumed in their entire economic life at this particular location. Both the Titan and the Innovator are designed to be reused numerous times through their life. So it's not really an abandonment. It's moving it from point A to point B. Titan, we already have the second location designed for it. It's down at Atwater 63.
Right. I appreciate that. But there were a certain number of properties covered in the first letter. other properties been named in subsequent letters?
I'm not aware of any other properties that have been named. If there are some, I'm not denying that there are, but I am certainly not aware of any new properties that have come up other than the two that I just mentioned.
The company is focused on responding to the BOEM issues, which are ongoing, which I don't think the BOEM is going to view as limited to just those on the letter. So we're going to have to address them all. But in direct answer, he's answered your question precisely. But don't take away from that that the company is not focused on addressing any requirements the BOEM may have for the Telemark and Gomez properties, because although those are not listed, as Mr. Reese just mentioned, they're part of the ongoing dialogue. So I just wanted to clarify, our dialogue with the BOEM encompasses those properties listed on, I think what you're referring to is the letter we refer to as the August 17th correspondence. In addition, there were some other properties which were the subject of ongoing dialogue, which remain the subject of ongoing dialogue. It wouldn't surprise me if we get a letter on those at some point soon, but we are still working with the government on those. We have retained third-party professionals who are doing what we call decommissioning estimates, which are a lot more sophisticated than the algorithm programs the government uses. That will be part of the evidence we use in going back to deal with the government and to negotiate with them on these issues. We have a meeting scheduled later this week. It is an ongoing process.
I very much appreciate the response. I thought it was very complete. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
If I can, Benjamin Cadden again for Warrior Energy. At the last hearing, the Department of Justice's attorney made reference to a potential additional $230 million, I believe, in bonding. Has the debtor received any written notification that this is forthcoming, that they're going to make that demand? Have they given you oral notification that that's coming in the near future?
That's
the first time you heard it as well.
No, we received a letter recently. I don't remember the number, 230.
In excess of 200.
Received a letter like that?
No, I mean, it's...
I haven't seen it. So if he's referring
to... You've been on vacation.
Sorry.
So, but no, that's... No, that's what I'm saying. This is an ongoing dialogue. I could go into it, but basically I'd be repeating myself. It's an ongoing dialogue as to how we address it. I mean, we need to address the abandonment obligations. That is very easily part of our budget. There's also, since we're no longer exempt and we have to, in essence, post some form of financial security for the BOEM, that's what we're working through right now, both the amount as well as the manner in which it can be posted. It's also not just a situation where, I'll use your number, $230 million, whatever the number is, that we have to write a check for that.
That was my follow-up question, is whether you had already started down the path of looking at bonding or depositing half or whatever the various options are, if the debtors looked into those.
Sure. I mean, there's always the obligation of, you know, here's your $230, how do you want to satisfy it? Well, one of the ways you can satisfy it is if you happen to have partners that are exempt partners, you could bring them into the fold, and as a working interest owner, they can put that on their schedule, and in doing so, we would no longer be responsible for a bonding requirement in that particular situation. Yes, we'd still be in the title chain, we'd still have our obligation, but, you know, large-scale partner that is exempt, they would then be able to take that property. So there's many different ways to exist to basically satisfy what the ultimate bonding amount will be. And part of it's negotiation, and part of it is making sure you have the right partners or you have bonding in place.
Are the known P&A liabilities in the August 17th letter in the schedules listed as a liability? Because I didn't see them listed, scheduled anywhere.
I don't think they are. No. I think that schedule of liabilities, as it says, were effective as of July 31st. I believe the date of the reporting is effective as of July 31st. But I don't believe the company agrees with the numbers in those in that order anyway. So we would have to figure out how we would address that in any.
Would the debtor amend his
schedules once that number is agreed upon and finalized? Or would it take the position that it didn't exist as a petition?
We'll disclose it, but the question is how we will do with that in our schedule. We'll have to address that when the time comes.
Mr. Ryan?
Christopher Ryan with Baker Hughes. MC711, is that a floating platform?
Yes, it's the it's the ATP Innovator is moored at MC711.
So I wasn't sure if that was at MC711. Are you going to file with the court reserve reports?
I do not know if we will file reserve reports or not. I would leave that to the legal team as to whether we are required and what best practices would be.
Thank you.
Moving on to number 23. Number 23 are payments, withdrawals from the partnership or distributions by the corporation. We've touched on, gotten part of the answer on there are a number of payments to the directors on 41012. And my other question is on 41012.
I think Ken Green has a question. Nancy, sorry. He was trying to get your attention.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
All right.
Quick question. Ken Green for Schlumberger. With respect to the affiliates that are listed on Schedule 18.
18?
18A. You've got a number of payments to affiliates listed on Schedule 18. You've got a number of payments to affiliates listed in Schedule 3B, 3C. You've also got claims fined against affiliates in your schedules. My question is, does the debtor have written agreements with these affiliates, or are these transactions just recorded as ledger entries on the accounting side?
The answer would be both. Between ATP Oil and Gas and ATP UK, I know there is a note that has been signed and memorialized. I think the advances between ATP, and I'm going to put ATP in general because it could have come from two different locations, and the ATP East Med entities, I believe those are just characterized as advances at this point. I don't think we've memorialized those as to whether they're debt or whether they're equity. That's currently being reviewed. Some of these, you know, actual payments to ATP Infrastructure Partners, LP, for example, that has to do with the actual use of the unit, so it would not necessarily be an intercompany amount. Same thing with the Titan. Titan has a Titan LLC. There's a PUA, platform use agreement, between ATP Oil and Gas and the Titan. And so those would not be just advances. That would actually be use of that particular property, but they're scheduled on here because they are intercompany.
Okay.
Sure.
Anything else up through 23? So on 23, I was asking, you told us on that these director's fees were paid on April the 10th. And that was their annual payment. Was it their annual payment going back for 2011, annual fees they've earned, or was it annual fees going forward for 2012?
Ms. Holly, I'm sorry, I do not know whether it's
backwards or forwards.
I just know that they get an annual fee about then.
Okay. And at the time those payments were made, what was the financial situation of the company?
In April, we reported cash on the balance sheet of about 200 and something million as of March 31st. I can stand corrected on that amount, but it was probably in that ball frame. So certainly from a cash standpoint, we were sufficient at that point.
There were also at least two bonuses recorded at 23. Doesn't actually have a date on it. It says various dates.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Leland Tate of $150,000 and Mr. Paul Buhlman of $225,000 bonus. I mean, they've got salaries, they've got 401k match, they've got stock. So what is Mr. Tate's position with the company?
He is president.
Today?
Yes.
And how long has he held that position?
2008 or 9, maybe 10. He's been with us since 2001. And it was during 8 or 9, maybe 10, that he became president.
Okay. And Mr. Buhlman?
Buhlman has been, he's the founder of the company. He was president prior to Leland becoming president. Once Leland became president, Paul became CEO. And then in June of this year, he relinquished the CEO title and was named executive chairman.
And that's his position today?
Yes. Yes. Executive chairman is the officer position, and he is chairman of the board also.
Anybody else have any questions about 23?
To answer a question that you asked in an email but you didn't ask here.
All right.
The various date for Mr. Tate and for Mr. Buhlman on their bonus was 12/30/11. December 30, 1911. No, not 1911, 2011. I knew that didn't sound right as soon as I said it.
So you'll be able to... So that is the various date?
Yes.
It was one date?
Yeah, it was one date. It got listed various, and instead it should have been 12/30/11.
Okay, so you're that may be making one. That change in the statement of financial affairs, right?
Yes, I will.
For 23.
So for 23, you will see a date in there next time.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions about anything in the statement of financial affairs before we move to the schedule?
Let me check my hand, Warren. I'm not sure if you covered the schedule. This is very apparent on behalf of the ad hoc committee, secondly, with respect to the ORRIs, are there any insiders that hold or referred to as the ORIs, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge.
Are there any former insiders that hold any ORIs?
As I said earlier, Jerry and Candy Schleif, they are a participant with the, I'll refer to as the Guggenheim override that we put in place in January of 2010. Jerry has been with the company essentially since the very beginning. He retired in 2007, and during that period of time since then, he has been a consultant to us on various transactions.
Just so I'm clear, what was his position with the company?
He was senior vice president, I think was his final title. His focus was on acquisitions and divestitures.
Do we need to take a break?
I'm still good right
still
now.
Still good?
It's up
okay.
to the witness.
I'm
right.
still good.
We'll keep continuing. Just as a general housekeeping matter, again, restrooms are across the hall, water fountain work. Okay, moving on to the schedules. Schedule A is real property. It's got an attachment with a number of properties listed. Does anybody have any questions about Schedule A? Or, Mr. Reese, do you know if there need to be any corrections, additions, deletions? Schedule A.
I am not aware of any, but again, I reserve the right to make changes.
Are your leases, the oil and gas interest in the leases listed in Schedule A or Schedule B? My reading is that they're in B-29.
I see some in A, pages 3 and 4.
The question is, if it's a legal question,
5,
Mr. Kelly
six.
Can answer it. But the question is, why would the oil and gas insult interest be listed as personal property interest as opposed to real property interest?
Well, I don't know that there's a clear answer here because it appears that they're listed on schedule of real property under pages 3, 4, 5, and 6. I see the BOEM leases. Are they listed twice? I have to be honest with you, they perhaps are. The DOJ takes the position that these are sometimes not real property interests but pure leases. We have tried to play it down the middle of the fairway on this until we have to take a position in the case. If we listed them as both, I don't know that we divided them. So I'm assuming they're listed in both places. I would need to check that to make sure, or visit with one of my folks who did the listing.
But the value is reflected in the
I'm going to let Mr. Reese testify as to what value is reflected on Schedule B. But I think it's my understanding there may be book value listed as to what's in
that's
Schedule
what I think. I think that's what it is.
Are you referring to B-29?
Right.
That's what I'm going to look at. Yes, B-29, to fast forward to there, that is cost basis, total cost, and that is book value, which would be the cost basis minus accumulated DD&A. There's no attempt to say this is PV-10 value or anything of that nature.
Right. And so just to clarify, you list the leases in Schedule A, but you do not put the value there, put the value over in Schedule B.
B-29, that's where they listed it, yes. It appears
not
to
knowing
be.
How you're defining value, what's in B-29.
Where it says current market value.
We don't. Blank.
Blank.
We've listed the book value on B-29.
Right. Yes.
Why was the book value used as opposed to a reserve-based market value?
I suspect while he's looking at that, our reserves aren't done by lease, they're done by formation.
Yeah, pay, Schedule B-29, looking at the top, it has cost basis and book value. I don't think we made the determination of let's put cost and book value in there. I mean, that's purely financials. From a PV-10 standpoint, if that's what you're getting to, that we have disclosed just in the reserve reports that we filed. But market value, you're going to have what's a willing buyer and a willing seller.
Right. Right. And in Schedule A, which again, where we have the blanks, that's where it calls for a market value on the pool.
Correct.
Okay.
So do you have that information?
Certainly not at my fingertips.
On a lease-by-lease basis, does the company have that information?
Our reserves are prepared on a property-by-property basis. And in doing the property, you may have three leases that make up a property, some of which are producing, some of which are not. As Charles said, in preparing the valuation for the PV-10 and what goes into PV-10, that goes actually to the well that is producing within a particular reservoir, and you can have behind pipes and undeveloped and things of that nature. So I'm not sure you would actually have an apples and apples comparison to that you could lay down a market value for each of these leases on here.
And the company doesn't take the position the PV-10 is reflective of market value.
That's where I was going to go next. I mean, a reserve report is nothing more than a mathematical exercise of an engineering estimate. And what someone is willing to pay for that, the market value, can be significantly greater or significantly less than a PV-10 value.
The current reserve report has not been completed yet?
We have a reserve report completed by our outside engineer as of 12/31/11. In preparing for the case, the company did its own internal estimate based on the prior outside third-party estimates, and we rolled it forward with known adjustments to June 30th. That's the most recently released information by the company.
And you have one being
We do not have one being prepared. The lenders have one being prepared by Netherland Sewell for Clipper, for Telemark, and for Gomez.
Okay.
Benjamin Cadden again for Warrior Energy. If we can go back to Schedule A, I know we're talking about the current market value. The next column that's blank is the amount of secured claims. And for a creditor, short of going to the relevant parish and county records and doing an abstract, how is it possible for any creditors to tell which properties are encumbered by the first and second lien debt? And I guess the dovetail of that is when you get to Schedule D and you list the first and second lien debt, you put a value number of their collateral, I think it's $417 million. I'm trying to back into what the encumbered properties are and which ones are unencumbered, and I think usually Schedule A is used for that purpose because the secured claim amount would be zero on the unencumbered and be filled in for those that were encumbered by the first and second lien debt.
Okay. Since the filing of the DIP, for practical purposes, I think you can assume that 100% of all of our leases are somehow encumbered by the first lien.
By now, the DIP.
By the DIP.
I understand that, but the DIP is subject to a number of pre-existing liens, including senior statutory liens.
Correct.
And in order for me as a creditor's attorney to determine whether I am a senior statutory lien holder, I need to know which properties were unencumbered pre-petition.
We testified about that on the first day.
Are people still filing those liens?
Absolutely.
So how in the world are they supposed to have them as of the petition date?
That's not what you said. I'm not asking for a list of the lien holders. I'm asking for are encumbered by the first and second lien debt. So I know if I'm a holder of a lien on an unencumbered pre-petition or encumbered.
We